Thanks.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Illinois is one of America's leading agricultural states. We make soybeans and corns and pigs. Corns, that's interesting. We make soybeans and corn and pigs, lots of pigs. Pumpkins, too. And farming is everywhere. The state's Department of Agriculture says Illinois' 72,000 farms cover about three-quarters of our land area. But there are dangers for and in this bounty. Last year, a remarkably rainy spring meant 1.5 million acres of Illinois farmland was not planted, which is a tenfold increase over the usual. My guest today says that may become increasingly common. Tom Philpott is a food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones. He was also once a farmer himself. His new book is Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom Philpott, welcome to The 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you have a question about the future of farming in America and in Illinois in particular, you can always join our conversations. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Maybe you've embraced one of the sort of trends that he writes about. You've gone paleo, you're eating mostly meats and proteins, or maybe you're doing the sort of Michael Pollan thing, eat plants mostly, which we're going to talk about how those relate to what his argument is about the future of food in America. Join the conversation at 800-222-9455. So I want to begin. If one of our listeners here in Illinois walks into a supermarket, we're likely to see a bounty of produce, right? It's one of the first things you see when you walk in. Where is much of that coming from?
Typically, pretty much no matter what time of year it is, it's probably mostly coming from California, and mostly from a couple of growing regions there. And the biggest one is called the Central Valley, which is this big valley that cuts right up the center of the state between the Sierra Nevada mountain ranges and the coastal mountains.
And I mean, this is, I think you write in your book that this is more than a third of the vegetables and two thirds of the fruits and nuts grown in the United States. They all come from this Central Valley of California. Do people have an appreciation for that? Maybe you can talk about the story you shared early on in your book about, you know, when you were farming yourself and sort of supplying, local, I imagine, fancier restaurants that get into the local food movement, and you started facing competition from across the country.
Yeah, so this was in about the mid-2000s, and Michael Pollan's book Omnivore's Dilemma had just come out. We were selling into a farmer's market in Boone, North Carolina, which is up in the mountains, and, you know, lots and lots of people coming to the farmer's market and also selling to restaurants. And I noticed that this business that we had taken over, it was my girlfriend's father's farm and his produce business that we had taken over. We were famous for our salad greens, and we did these really delicate, fancy, delicious salad mixes of like arugula and other, and some Asian greens. And we got a pretty good price from them from restaurants, you know, based on their quality. And suddenly I started getting intimations from chefs that while they really liked the product and they loved featuring it, they were suddenly getting, it was available to them, organic greens from California, which they admitted weren't nearly as good, but they were less than half the price. And could we do something about our price? And it was just sort of a reminder to me, and as I, you know, talk to more people and more farmers, that there is this, if you want to get into wholesale, this is already happening, if you wanted to get into wholesale markets in this area of Appalachian North Carolina, you had to meet or beat the California price. And so it's sort of exerting downward pressure on the amount you can get paid for your produce in the area. And I think that the arrival of organic greens, you know, that started to hit at our sort of niche restaurant business.
Yeah, and I think we're accustomed to realizing that maybe California took over the supermarket sort of produce business. Takeover is the wrong way to say that, maybe, but I mean, it's certainly making inroads up and down the food chain. So what then, as we look to California, what are some of the biggest threats facing California's food production?
Yeah, so what makes that bounty perilous, to go back to the title of my book, is that, so California agriculture in the Central Valley, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a great place to grow food. And I think people in Illinois can appreciate how great it is because it's got a Mediterranean climate, which means, you know, long, very warm, you know, even hot summers, very mild winters, which is given to year-round production. And the constraint there is water, because the Central Valley itself gets very little rain in the summer. But lo and behold, you everywhere you are in the valley, unless the air is really bad, you can see the Sierra Nevada mountains, and they provide this incredible snowpack that gathers up a huge amount of the weather that is generated in the South Pacific during the winter months. Much of that evaporation that goes into the sky ends up falling as snow in the Sierra Nevada. And there's been this incredible infrastructure built up over the last about century to convey that snowmelt to farms all summer long. And so you get this kind of paradise of, you're not worrying about rain coming like a, you know, huge storm like just happened to you guys in the Midwest, coming and flattening your crops. You're not worrying about very much about fungal diseases that take root in wet climates. And when you need to irrigate, you essentially just push a button and like magic, you've got irrigation where you want it to go. And so it's a great place to grow food. The problem is that with climate change, that snowpack has been shrinking palpably over the past 30 years. Most famously, the big drought that happened from 2011 to 2016. And yeah. So as the snowpack shrinks, and farming gets ever bigger and ever more ravenous for water, what you're seeing is that they're increasingly relying on underground wells.
And okay,
so they're tapping.
I need to interrupt you there, because we're going to have to hold for 1 second and take a quick break. We have a caller on the line with a question. We're going to be talking a lot more about The Perilous Bounty, Tom Philpott's book, with the author. This is The 21st. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Tom Philpott for the rest of the hour. He's a food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones, also once a farmer himself. His new book is Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. As always, the phone lines are open, 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on the line. I'm going to ask her to hold for just another minute while we sort of move. Let's wrap up our conversation on California, because I do want to get to the Midwest. Obviously, this is an Illinois-based show. So before the break, I had to rudely interrupt you. You were about to talk about the droughts and the aquifers drying up, I think, in California, and some of the threats
So what's happening there is that the aquifer is essentially being emptied at much faster a rate than it's being replenished, and so you're seeing it being drawn down, and so you're getting, you know, saltier water, which doesn't grow crops as well, but you're getting more expensive water because you have to pump it up using, you know, basically fossil fuels to drive those pumps. And so you're looking at a situation where that the way that we're doing it can't go on forever.
And I will say to listeners, if you know, read the book. There's a great, also a fascinating section on an episode from California history. I was not aware of a great flood that came there. I think you can even find an excerpt of that on Mother Jones' website, or an adaptation of chapter. But it's fascinating. We don't have time to talk about it now because I do want to get to the Midwest. And you talk about your first time in corn and soy country. You say, on my first visit to this landscape, these fields struck me as the most impressive and brutal example I'd seen of humanity's will to reorganize reorder landscapes to its whims, as impressive as the Manhattan skyline. Can you talk about your first time in the Midwest and you know what you think of as the you know the chief threats facing our plentiful corn belt we have here?
Yeah, so it was back around 2007, and I was reporting on the Corn Belt for Grist, and I had been writing about sort of corn and soybean dominated agriculture for a couple of years, and I got to go there, and I was just landed in Des Moines, and just went out into the country and stayed in a bed and breakfast. This is before Airbnb. I was just really excited to get out into the countryside. And I do remember plunging my hand into, the Airbnb or the B&B was right by, sort of cut out of a cornfield, the house was. And I remember just running out and plunging my hand into the soil and just, you know, it was middle of the season, corn was really high, and just being so impressed by this black, deep, rich soil that we didn't have in the mountains of North Carolina. But then just driving around for that reporting trip, just, you know, seeing uninterrupted field after field of corn and soybeans with the occasional set of CAFOs, you know, giant hog factory farms breaking up the monotony. It was quite something for me.
And you haven't, yeah. I was just to say, so you mentioned and talk about the sort of industrialized nature of agriculture, and you write that I think it's easy for some people, especially on the left in the environmental movement, to sort of look at corn and soy farmers of the Midwest and portray them as villains. But this is a pretty hard business to be in, especially, you know, the closer you get to the ground, so to speak, right?
Yeah. So, you know, basically, the fundamental problem, I think, for farmers in the region is that they're growing a product that they're growing two products, corn and soybeans, that puts them in hyper competition with their neighbors because everyone is growing the same thing. And that would be one thing. I mean, because, you know, we've seen this sort of consolidation in the Midwest. Everyone there knows this, that there used to be a lot more farmers. Farms have gotten fewer and fewer and bigger, which has been a big problem for a lot of towns in the region. And so as the number of farmers drops, well, you think, well, you know, maybe they get some leverage. There are fewer of them. Maybe they can have some leverage with these big grain buyers and meat companies that buy all the corn and soybeans as feed. But what it turns out is in the past 20 years, Brazil, especially Brazil, but also Argentina, have put an incredible amount of land under cultivation. And in the case of Brazil, it's basically savanna that had not been developed ever just in the past 20, 25 years. And so now you're not just competing with your neighbors, but you're competing with, you know, really, really big growers in Brazil and increasingly Argentina. And so what that means is that you're under just this hyper competition that's global. Now, Ukraine is coming into the game with it. It's got a great prairie-derived topsoil region there. And so you're in hyper competition with your neighbors, and yet your buyers, there's just that real handful of buyers, like, you know, eventually the big meat companies are buyers, and you've got Cargill and ADM that basically don't have to compete very much with each other because they've got such little competition. And then you as a farmer are in this, you know, kind of Darwinian competition. And as a result of that, prices for most years are at or below the cost of production. And there was an interruption in the ethanol period from about 2006 to 2011 or so, where you know, we're getting compensated for your work from the actual marketplace. The ethanol boom, as we all know, was a government concocted. It was not actually the free market speaking. It was a government program. But in general, the story there with farmers is they're not getting compensated for what they grow in the marketplace, and they're having to rely on, you know, crop subsidies, subsidized crop insurance, you know, these recent payments from the Trump administration. And so, yeah, it is a really, really tough business. And I want people to recognize that.
Yeah, and I mean, you talked about this a little bit, but it's interesting. I think you say the degree to which farms deal with oligopolies, right? You have just a handful of companies that are making the machinery that farmers use. John Deere, of course, being one known well known to Illinois listeners, and same thing with where they get their seeds. And as you said, Cargill and ADM dominate the where they can send their products and who processes them. And you also look at soil erosion. And some of the chaotic spring weather, we certainly saw that here in Illinois, interfering with planting season. This is something that as climate change intensifies, we've certainly, all eyes have been on California this week, or I should say in recent weeks because of the fires there. But I mean, this sort of increasingly chaotic weather is potentially going to be a big problem as well.
Yeah, and I think that the delayed planting that happened last year got a lot of the headlines. But what I kind of tease out on the book is that there was something else happening that was an even bigger deal. And that is just the simple thing that when you grow corn and soybeans as your two crops and you harvest them at the same time and you plant them at the same time, then you're getting this period almost landscape wide, you know, the entire corn belt, where you've got bare land confronting these increasingly strong storms. And I document in the book that a farmer who is, you know, let's say in his or her mid-60s has seen changes over the past 30 years in their careers, where the storms are getting a lot more frequent, they're getting a lot more, you know, intense. And so when you get these intense weather events hitting bare land, what happens is soil goes on the move at an alarming rate. And I'm sure everyone around there, if you were driving around last May or June, you were seeing these ephemeral gullies, these gashes in the land where basically the rain, you know, hits the soil and sends it moving through these contours in the land. And, you know, the typical way that farmers deal with it, I hate to say, is by sort of pushing it over with their tractors, filling it back in again. And as I, you know, lay out in the book, that's like a pipeline taking soil off of farms. And obviously it's not just soil, but it's also the chemicals that have been applied to that soil. But the erosion rates are, I think, alarming.
Yeah. And I want to go down to the phones. Lynn, you have been waiting so patiently, and I want to thank you for that. Calling from Central Illinois. Welcome to the 21st, and go ahead with your question, please.
Well, thank you for taking a call. I've worked as a volunteer with the Northwest Food Alliance, the Midwest Food Alliance. I was a grower in Tucson, on Maui, in Portland, and in Central Illinois, where I grew up child labor, happily, in an era that's lost. 4-H and youth that used to be able to walk what was newer crops, that would be the hybrid and the engineered crops that, you know, there's not a left or right about a conversation, really. So the question is, you know, I've heard your interview before. I used to take Mother Jones when I was a graduate student in University of Illinois, I'll say 30-some years ago, and since then I've lived around the country. The alarming erosion rate in Brazil, the author probably knows that those Archer Daniels Midland owned crops in Brazil were planted on deforested land that then, when the water came after the trees were gone, dumped over a lot of rail cars and trucks. You know, I think 22 trucks was the news story we got out of Brazil. When we were on Maui, we had a lot different news source because of the number of Brazilians that knew about ADM and the loss of grain. The subsidies and the land use and the CREP land, C-R-E-P, that apparently President Trump has tried to create some initiative in the recent farm bill about repurposing the set-aside lands that, as you say, we're not sure what they really are used for other than subsidization, but that then also untold stories about hexane toxicity and alarming rates that were never reported of pediatric cancers and such that continue. About hexane is the chemical, of course, used to derive all of those byproducts that are sold as everything from makeup to pet food to industrial solvent and the rest. And the rates, again, of employees that some of the socioeconomics of those organizations that created farmer as a lost profession. I believe it's not incorrect that census, you can't even claim to be a farmer on the census now as your job. Even the title has been co-opted. So I guess one of my questions would be, one, with youth being so displaced, one of the things that was interesting about sort of, if you understand the politics, which I know you do, of extension programs from land-grant universities, and we saw immigrant labor have to come over and drive the huge trucks. In fact, there were local stories about farmers, noted farmers, that couldn't find labor from Africa or wherever these folks were coming, these scientists, I believe, to drive these monster machines that harvest acres at a time. What about the youth displaced? You know, Illinois almost lost its 4-H chapter.
Yeah. I'm gonna jump in there because we only have a couple of minutes left in our show. I want to thank you for calling and Tom. I know your book sort of explicitly says it could, you know, there are a lot of things going on in American agriculture. It could be about labor. It's not one of the things you necessarily focused on, although it does run through. You know, farmers are definitely have that in mind, especially in California. I don't know if you want to respond briefly to what our caller had to say there.
Well, I want to respond really quickly to one thing she said about Brazil, and she raised an important point about how you see exact same companies, exact same oligopolies that U.S. farmers deal with are also basically at the top of the game in Brazil. And so it's no skin off them. The competition from Brazil doesn't hurt them at all. In fact, it helps them. It's more people buying their products. It's more product to buy. It drives prices down. In terms of labor, I think there is a definite need. I think, you know, basically that is sort of the next step in the analysis I make in the book about, you know, we have degraded as a culture. And I think from the very founding of the country, we've degraded farm labor, you know, basically in the original 13, you know, states of the United States. Especially in the South, farm labor was mostly enslaved labor. In California, from the very founding of California as a U.S. state, Mexican labor has played a key role. It's been a key reason why California farming has boomed, and I think there are going to be problems there going forward, obviously, and I talk about those in my book a bit. But I think revaluing farm labor and making it into a living wage job that doesn't have awful conditions like we're seeing now in the COVID-19 crisis, I think is going to be really important going forward. It's just one other major change that we have to make.
All right. And for more of those changes recommended by our guest, Tom Philpott, you're going to have to go to the book because I'm afraid we are out of time. The book is Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
I really love being here. Thank you so much.
And that is it for today. I want to thank our callers. We love it when you call in and bring your questions. I'm sorry if we weren't able to get to your call today. Please do call back again. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll be back again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.